Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-hosts, Alfred Addisk and James Corbett of the Corbett Report, will be joining you immediately following the first commercial break of the program. But first, let's get started with the market reports. A lot of strange things going on in the markets today for Thursday, June 16th, 2016. I was all excited, most of the day anyway, to report gold's rise of $20 today, and as a follow-through from the decision from the Fed not to raise rates, and that easy money policy is still intact, and also some gains coming from the Brexit referendum next week. However, unfortunately, there was a tragedy. A member of parliament was shot and killed today, and rumors had started to circulate to the postponement of the vote of the referendum of the Brexit on June 23rd. Supposedly, gold started to sell off at that point in time. And we had about a $36 spread from high to low today. And so currently we're looking at 1281 and 1281 showing 11 down, but that was from the spreads all day. So still $1,281 is not a bad place to be. Silver is down 34. We saw the same thing. It was approaching $18 on the day. We're showing down 34 at 1726. Platinum was down 6 at 973, palladium down 1 at $535. So if I confused you on gold, gold is down 1140 at 1281, silver down 34 at 1726. And again, there was a huge spread swing on gold today of 36, had a high, I think it was about 1318. And to have it drop to 1281. The U.S. dollar today saw the same thing. Big drop in the dollar, came back up for the day, up 0.03 at 94.61. Crude oil still took a beating, though. That didn't come back. 1.96 to the downside at 46.05. Paper markets seemed to rejoice that the referendum was going to be possibly. They didn't say they were going to. It was just a rumor, of course. Was up 108 points at 17,748. The NASDAQ is up 8, 4,842. The S&P was up 6, 2077. The 10-year yield shows people are still running into these bonds, 1.56% on the 10-year yield. The euro was down slightly, 0.16 at 112. And Japan was down huge. Of course, it didn't have any, the situation in Europe didn't have any, or in Britain didn't have any impact on Japan, of course. That was down another 3%. Hong Kong was down another 2%. London and Germany were down just slightly in overnight trading. But what happened in England? The UK Member of Parliament, Joe Cox, was killed after being shot twice. According to some sources, Cox, who is a member of the Labour Party, was a strong campaigner for the Remain side for next week's referendum. A Chicago trader who wished to remain anonymous said that people are questioning whether or not the vote's going to happen. And that is why gold was reacting. See, I look at it differently. I can't imagine that's why. I would have thought gold would go stronger after you have one of your major politicians shot and killed. So, I think this was somewhere along the line. There has to be a major trade in there to push gold down that quick and that big. Unless, we haven't gotten the information as far as maybe they canceled the referendum totally. But I don't believe that. So to me, I think it would strengthen both sides. You know, they were talking about the people that were undecided at this point in time would actually vote to stay within the European zone. Because they don't want to cause any waves. So they prefer status quo. That's why they're undecided. And I don't know, but we did hit prior to this, gold did hit a 22-month high of 1318 an ounce. Gold holdings in the ETFs were at the highest since October 2013. You have the silver-backed funds. They are also at a record. And prices of both metals, of course, before they pulled back, were up more than 23% this year. And again, folks, you hear it every day. Gold and silver are not going anywhere. I hear some analysts saying, oh, you don't want to buy gold until it hits 900. Well, if you wait until it hits 900, you never will buy gold. If you wait for silver to go lower, you will never buy gold, because I do not believe silver is going to 900. And the problem is, these idiotic statements are never backed up by any information or facts. We tell you the facts here. We tell you the facts here. The long-term fundamentals of gold and silver are strong. They're not changing. Prices will go higher. It's all relative. Even if prices stay the same and we had a collapse and a reset of our currency, you'll fare much better by owning gold at these levels than you would owning paper. Because when you own paper and we have a reset, that paper is going to be adjusted, but your gold will remain the same. So, yes, I do expect prices to go higher. But you know what? People are getting confused about why you buy gold. I listened to the Goldfinger interview, and most of it that I could. It was mainly a pitch to buy their strategies. The person that they talked so much about being interviewed was there probably for, 15 minutes of the hour and a half program. So if we have time, we'll talk about some of their recommendations for the actual physical metal. But I want to go on and talk about what happened with gold today. Our comments that perhaps that politician was from Frank. He says she was sacrificed for the cause. But I'm not so sure that will, unless they totally cancel that, I would think it could possibly strengthen the other side. I don't know, but we'll have to see what happens. The timing is everything, folks, and it's quite a, I guess it was a 50-year-old man that got... one more thing I wanted to say. I believe England is a gun-free zone. I think they have very strict gun controls over there. So, and that's a whole other situation that's happening over here. But let me go back to gold. So, again, if you wait for 900, you probably won't get it bought because gold is not going to 900. And there's never any information and facts to back up these low prices. It reminds me of the 90s. One of the biggest gurus, so-called gurus of the silver today, I don't think much of them, but in the 90s, he was telling people not to buy silver when you could buy it for a couple of bucks per ounce. And if you listened to him, he slammed you into paper so you could lose like everybody else did during the dot-com crash. He only became interested in silver when both gold and silver started to take off. Only when we were going to have a housing crisis back in 2006 and 2007, all of a sudden, when prices started to move up, now all of a sudden he was an expert in silver and he wanted you to buy silver. But what did he do in the 90s to help anyone? Because they don't believe in the fundamentals. They believe in churning you. They want to trade you because that's how they make their money. They churn people to earn more commissions. So you have to be very careful. And it's not that I don't like any of these people. I mean, it's like, oh boy, she doesn't like anybody and so forth. I don't like what they promote. I don't like their advice. I don't like their opinions on positioning people's portfolios because I don't see how it benefits people. A lot of their information about what is happening in the markets and in our economies and our government and our politics, they can be spot on. I think they miss a lot, and they've been saying the same thing for years, and usually all their predictions are always wrong. But yet you'll hear them claim to be they were right on all these cases. Well, no, they weren't. They were all wrong, but nobody looks it up. Everybody has short memories. So again, just be careful, and I'm more than happy to answer any of your questions or any talk about some of the things that you hear being promoted out there. And I'll tell you if it's a good thing or I'll tell you if it's a bad thing. Consumer price index today, that measures what Americans pay for everything, cars, car repairs, to food, that increased. It was seasonally adjusted in May. 0.2%. This was released today. It's the third straight monthly rise in overall prices as the dampening effects of low oil prices and a strong dollar fade. If Janet Yellen was looking for a little bit of inflation, well, she's been getting it. So this isn't her argument anymore that she's not getting enough inflation. Consumer prices, you know, excluding the often volatile food and energy categories also rose 0.2% in May. It's the largest one-month jump since February 2007. Energy prices rose 1.2% from April, including a 2.3% jump in gas prices. What I find interesting is food prices fell 0.2%, including a 0.5% decline in food purchase for home consumption. So not just restaurants, but, you know, how much you buy and take home. I tell you where I go shopping, and I think I shop at a, you know, fairly low key grocery store. It's not one of your big chains that has, you know, their, you know, own restaurants inside and so forth, and where they sell seafood and everything else. And I don't remember seeing any of my prices falling to where I actually was saving any money. It was the fifth time in the past 7 months that grocery prices had declined. Hey, if you have seen your grocery prices decline, call me and let me know. Clothing prices, apparel, that rose. Prices for both new and used vehicles declined. If you exclude food and energy prices, that climbed 2.2% on the year, making the seventh consecutive month that annual core inflation matched or exceeded 2%. So there you go. There you have your 2% inflation that Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve is always crying about. That doesn't really mean anything because we all know that our inflation is much higher than 2%. Foreign investors sold a record amount of U.S. Treasury bonds and notes for the month of April. This is according to the U.S. Treasury Department. Foreigners sold $74.6 billion in U.S. Treasury debt in the month. April's outflow was the largest since the U.S. Treasury Department started recording these debt transactions. January of 1978. And it goes to show you exactly what is happening around the world and what is happening here. China remains the largest foreign holder of U.S. government debt, although its holdings in April declined. This is what I found interesting. Japan, the number two foreign U.S. Treasury debt holder, posted higher U.S. government debt holdings. In March, Japan raised its U.S. Treasury holdings for a fourth straight month. That coincides with their policy of negative interest rates that the central bank had adopted at the end of January. So it's interesting that they go, they pay negative interest rates, but yet they're buying other debt that, of course, pays a little bit more. How much longer? Who knows? But I found that a little interesting. We have about, 2 minutes left in my 20-minute segment. I wanted to talk about, we'll hold it for tomorrow because I think it's interesting. And I've heard someone talk about this just recently as today. I'm sure we discussed it one point along the way where Ben Bernanke was supposedly where you'd be dropping money out of helicopters. Helicopter Ben would be dropping cash over your neighborhood courtesy of the Federal Reserve. That's at least the concept of helicopter money. And yesterday, Yellen didn't rule it out as a possible option in an extreme circumstance. That means they would write you checks. I can remember something after 9/11. I think everybody got a check for $600 or $800. Well, it'd be something along the same lines, but with a lot more money. It's something that one might legitimately consider, she said yesterday. And this was first introduced in 1969 as a concept by Friedman. Basically, the idea the Fed would essentially write a huge check to the U.S. Treasury Office, which would then send tax rebates, cash, to millions of Americans in the hopes that the Americans would spend the money. Ben Bernanke endorsed the idea at a last resort option. So helicopter money could prove a valuable tool for the Federal Reserve. And I do want to talk a little bit more about this because I heard a politician, I don't recall his name, talking about it, how they would eliminate all the welfare programs, which he didn't mention Social Security, but I would also have to think that would be in that same area. They would write everyone a check each month of approximately $1,000. And because we would be eliminating all the welfare programs, it would pay for the $1,000. Of course, there would be other taxes added to the equation, but he didn't want to talk about that on air. Something similar that Alaska does with the oil revenues. All the citizens of Alaska gets a part of the oil revenues on a monthly basis. So it'd be similar to that program. So the idea is in their heads. They've talked about it. They have a plan. And again, it shows you just how desperate they are. And it should make you pick up that phone and dial 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Call me. We'll talk. And in a few minutes, you'll be hearing Alfred and James Corbett talking for the next two segments of the program.
financial obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs Emotional Stress Formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now. American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is the American Independence Hour, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett. As you may know, if you listen to this program regularly, James is here most Wednesday nights and Thursdays when the program is rebroadcast. James, he lives and works in Japan, been there since 2004. Started the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com, in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's editorial writer for the International Forecaster and a prolific producer of videos and podcasts and articles that you see all over the Internet. Hello, James.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good, good, good. Can't complain at all. How's your son and your daughter treating you?
They're doing all right, but my daughter might be making an appearance. She's crying a little bit in the background.
Okay. Well, they want attention. Right? I don't know if you've seen little girls yet. You may have seen this other times, but one of the strangest things I can remember seeing. Couple little girls, they couldn't have been more than probably not even 2 years old, and they have their little dresses on at, I don't remember if it was a wedding or some sort of a family get together. I don't remember, this is 20-30 years ago, but here were these little girls holding their dresses out to the side and showing off their dresses to each other. And it was just extraordinary. It was the sort of vanity you would expect from someone 16 years old or 30 years old. But here were these little girls, and I mean, they could barely walk, and they were showing off their dresses. So I don't know if you've seen that before or not, but you will Daughter will
nature
do
or
it.
Nurture? Good question, yeah, but interesting.
Oh, nature. Nature, I think. If it's nurture, they catch on awfully fast. You know, just speaking of that, I saw a video back recently where they set up a surveillance camera in the room where in the child's room where they have children that are less than a year old. And they're standing up in their bassinets or whatever. And there were two of them. There was a little boy and a little girl in two separate, not bassinets, two separate cribs. And they're standing up and they're jumping around on there and they're having a good old time, laughing and giggling. And mom says something over the microphone that's attached to the camera. And as soon as they hear, the two of them fall down on the bottom of that little thing, their crib that they're in, and they pretend to be asleep. And I mean, these kids, they were just toddlers, right? They could barely stand up without holding on the edge, and they already knew at the sound of mom's voice, pretend to be asleep. I mean, the point behind this is these children are enormously more intelligent than we give them credit for. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, absolutely, including myself, think, oh, they don't begin to know what's going on until they're 5 or 8 years old or something. No, they really are.
Yeah, they really are. And I can attest to that with my 3-year-old son. And there are times when he has been incredibly perceptive, not only about objects that he can actually see or hear or perceive, although he is that too. Sometimes he'll hear an ambulance before myself or my wife hear it at all, and we'll say, what are you talking about? There's no ambulance. And then we'll start to hear the siren. But also in terms of the reading the emotional states and cues of things that are going on, and he's extremely perceptive. And although I kind of had an inkling of that before becoming a father, it's really jumped out at me now that I'm experiencing it on a day-to-day basis.
And it's pretty amazing. And one of the things, I wonder how old is a child typically before they begin to realize, I got to fool these people. I got to play dumb and keep this under my hat. Don't let these people know that I really know what's going on. I mean, because there's a point in time where our perception of children not being all that bright, you know, not being that knowledgeable, it's not just because we're failing to perceive them. It's because, like these two kids I was talking about in these cribs, they're pretending to be something that they're not, and they know this from a very early age. Very strange stuff. In any case, part of the fun of being a father.
Just before we leave that note, I think it's important to note that I think one of the first skills, or at least one of the first social skills that children learn, is how to manipulate parents or play parents off against each other. And you know, if dad won't let you do something, go crying to mom. And it's obvious why that would take place. But sometimes I think, again, parents aren't necessarily thinking that their children are that crafty. But of course they are.
Well, and the other point then is, if they're that crafty, it's up to parents to really encourage them and encourage their intellectual development from a very early age. And try to give them stuff that will occupy them in a positive way, something other than, how can we trick mom and dad? You know, it's...
Yeah, exactly right. Don't underestimate children.
No, I understand. Adults, you can underestimate the adults, but the children, probably not. You did a report on the Orlando shootings, an open source investigation. You noted that... over 50 people are dead after a shooting in a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida. The shooter has been identified as Omar Mateen, a 29-year-old resident of Fort Pierce, Florida. Mateen was a Muslim, a registered Democrat, a legal gun owner, and you didn't say so exactly. I mean, you raised the implication, but it's pretty much confirmed that the man was gay. And you said in the bingo card of suspicious events, we can check off Mateen allegedly took time out from the carnage to phone 911 and declare his allegiance to the Al-Qaeda, ISIS, that's your text.
That's my own appellation, but yes.
I understand. Meaning, ISIS is what we're talking about.
Yep.
He was previously known to the FBI. He was on their radar. Mateen's father hosts a broadcast from California. praises Taliban, recently posted a YouTube video announcing his candidacy for Afghan president. I've seen another report that says the father is some sort of a CIA operative. I don't know that any of this is true, but certainly this is a strange situation. You know, Paul Craig Roberts wrote an article, and it was dealing with the possibility that this thing was some sort of a hoax. And he pointed out, with all 50 bodies, over 50 people were allegedly killed, and another 63 that were wounded, he was saying, where are the bodies on TV? He was wondering if this was some sort of a hoax. No videos were seen from insiders, people inside. There were, I don't know how many people inside the building, but some of them texted and some of them sent out messages. Nobody apparently recorded a video, or if they have, it hasn't reached the public yet. This guy had to reload at least four times when he was firing that rifle. There's over something like 110 casualties, maybe more. Even if he had 30-round clips, he'd have to reload at least four times. Nobody jumped him. How did he get into that place with a rifle? My understanding is Florida law, they've got to run the wand on anybody who comes into a saloon and to make sure they're not packing a pistol. How did this guy get in with a rifle? So we have a bunch of odd questions, and what do you think about this? Is this becoming more curious, or are we finding reasonable explanations for, you know, anomalies?
Well, there are always attempts at explanations for these types of anomalies. I suppose it depends on your level of credulity at the various sources that the accusations are coming from, and then at the sources where the explanations are coming from. And I guess each person can decide for themselves on that point. To my own thinking, the idea that this was all a hoax, nothing happened, no one died, is preposterous on its face to me. Certainly certain aspects of this may not be as presented. In fact, almost certainly I would say that there are certain aspects of what happened in there that have not been accurately presented in the media. But the idea that no one died because we did not see bodies, dead bodies on TV, I would ask yourself and your listeners to think about how many times they saw the dead bodies of people on the street in various terrorist atrocities in times past. When the Bologna bombings happened back in 1981, did they show dozens of corpses lying on the street on television? Probably not. Does that mean those corpses did not exist? That is the logic of a two-year-old. So I do not take those types of reports very seriously. But certainly, as I say, there are a lot of questions that do and need to be asked and should be asked about how someone enters a club like that with a giant rifle, which is being reported as an AR-15. But one of the most interesting reports I've seen on this recently is the fact that, oh, by the way, it wasn't an AR-15. It was a Sig Sauer MCX carbine, which has a Stanag magazine, which can be compatible with an AR-15 and 60 other firearms, but it otherwise has no major parts that interface with AR-15s in any way, shape, or form. And yet, go online and look at the news reports about this. Every single one talks about the AR-15, AR-15, AR-15. We have to ban AR-15s. So that seems to be part of the political agenda here. Again, many, many other questions, like you raised about the very suspicious activities of the father. There are pictures of him online with Congressman Dana Rohrabacher. He was some type of newscaster or some television personality on what was called in the mainstream media a, quote, U.S.-based Afghan satellite channel, which I did read at the time when I made that video report you're talking about, but it didn't quite click on me. A U.S.-based Afghan satellite channel, what could that possibly be? And Daniel Hopsticker has this up on his website, madcowprod.com, where he goes into this channel that the father is associated with, TV Payam Afghan, which, as it turns out, is is funded by Voice of America, which, as I'm sure the U.S. Listeners don't need to be told, is an outgrowth and an arm of the U.S. State Department and the CIA, quite openly on the record. It is a voice of the State Department around the world. So this is essentially a State Department-funded broadcast that his father is a part of, where he apparently either pretends to be the president of Afghanistan in exile or is attempting to portray himself as some sort of presidential candidate, but it's all very, very, very strange. Again, many, many, many valid questions about what actually took place in that club. But I think, as with so many of these, details continue to pour out and they trickle out here and there in drips and drabs. And I don't like to pronounce too much on these types of events until we start to see the propaganda narrative that shapes in reaction to it, because I think the reaction is so important in things like this. Will it be the type of defining event that is going to somehow consolidate, you know, a repeal of the Second Amendment or whatever else certain people are looking for? Or will it be used to shape a different agenda or a different narrative? And as you point out, the fact that it turned out to be a gay Muslim Democrat did not turn out well for those leftist outlets that wanted to immediately jump on this as possibly another, you know, crazed white Christian conservative racist shooter, you know, and look what he's doing. Oh, of course, he's a homophobe. The actual narrative turns out to be completely different. So I think I'm going to reserve ultimate judgment about this until we start to see, you know, how this plays out in the propaganda media.
Well, everybody's trying to spin this thing to their own. You know, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste, as Hillary Clinton has told us and Rahm Emanuel has told us. And that means when we see a crisis like this, or when politicians see this, this is viewed as an opportunity to make hay while the bodies bleed. And who's going to ultimately be blamed for this? Will we blame the Muslims or the gays or the AR-15s, or who's going to be blamed for this? Which way is the country going to go?
I think the other way of phrasing that question is, who will benefit from this? Whoever benefits is the one who controls the narrative about, really controls the battle for the public mind about who to blame this on. And in that sense, you certainly have the gun control advocates and people who are going to blame this on, you know, guns in general and try to implement their agenda. On the flip side of that, you're going to have the Trump supporters who are going to say, look, this is why we have to stop Muslim immigration to the United States. Yeah. And so there's clearly a benefit on either side, depending who the American public ends up siding with in this. So it certainly could be a boost either to Clinton's campaign or to Trump's campaign, again, depending how people react to it. And I think that's part of the fight we see going on right now. And of course, completely excluded from that equation is the manufacture and provocation and puppeteering of international terrorism by NATO under Operation Gladio, by the FBI and CIA in proven operations throughout, certainly through the last 15 years. If the last 15 years have taught us anything, it's that every single FBI bust that I can think of over the past 15 years, and dozens that have been documented even by mainstream outlets like the New York Times, has shown that in every single instance, it is someone who had ties to the FBI, who was an informant for the FBI, who was provocateured by the FBI, who was under surveillance by the FBI. And yet they are going to come out and say, look, now we need more power to surveil more of what you do.
Mm-hmm. When they, I mean, if you have them in your hands, essentially, and you let them go, and I don't blame them on one level, but it just, the point is, it becomes an impossible situation. What are you going to do about this? One of the things, I think you have to provide stronger security at public events. You've got to make sure everybody is, if it's illegal to pack a weapon at a particular arena, somebody's got to be there to make sure everybody gets checked on the way in. They've got to go through metal detectors and whatever. I don't know what the answer is, but certainly we're going to see some serious pressure on the Second Amendment. And we'll watch and see. These are dangerous times, strange times. We'll take a break for a couple of announcements, and I'll be back with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com in just a moment. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in an untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate in those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Or take your chances with the bad boys. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Folks, I'm here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. Here's more news, Brexit. Here's an article from Time magazine entitled, "Here's What to Expect If Britain Votes to Leave the European Union." It says, in part, "In the event of a leave vote, Britain must promptly notify the European Union, Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, the equivalent of the European Union's constitution, that allows for, one, a two-year period in which the terms of the leaver's exit are negotiated," which means they're not going to just say goodbye, have a referendum next week, and that's it. Okay, we're gone. It's going to be 2 years before this thing is fully negotiated. And the second point is, during this period, Britain would no longer be able to take part in any European Union decision-making. They'd be helpless. If European Union wanted to vote to get England, I don't know what England can do about it other than declare war. And three, any exit agreements must be approved by all 27 remaining European Union nations and the European Parliament. If one nation says, nope, we're not letting you go, what happens then? And then after 2 years and this approval by all 27 nations, then after Britain's formal exit, fresh negotiations could begin on any new trade deals. I'm much surprised. I actually kind of thought that Brexit was a situation where you just said, okay, we're out of here. Goodbye. And it's far more complex than that. And it's almost, it's going to be 2 years, even if they vote now, it's going to be 2 years minimum before they're actually allowed to leave. What's your comment on this? How are the English going to accept this? And can these rules even be maintained? Or will England just say, yes, you want it? Come on. You want us? You want to mess with us? Fine. Let's. You know, we've got a couple of nuclear weapons here. What are we going to do?
Well, I mean, that's ultimately the question. There is no precedent for this, so we don't know how this really works in practice. But certainly what you talk about is the mechanism for separation that is laid out in the Lisbon Treaty. But of course, that presupposes the British respect for the Lisbon Treaty, even as they vote to secede from it. So it could be implemented unilaterally by Britain all at once, just saying, we're out, goodbye. They could do that. Of course, that would mean the severing of diplomatic relations with the European Union, which is fairly unthinkable in the current political context. So I wouldn't expect that to happen, but it's certainly an option. They could simply say, we're out, we're gone, we're done, we have nothing to do with you. Nothing is off the table or unthinkable. It's just that that is extremely unlikely. So they probably would enter into the formal negotiations for that, could be a years-long process in order to figure out what type of relation Britain would have with the European Union after this is all done. So assuming that Britain wants to continue some sort of relation with the continent, they're going to have to engage in that process. But there's no written in stone principles that aren't open to negotiation in that case. Regardless, again, of what the text of the Lisbon Treaty says, if one of the countries simply refuses to respect the Lisbon Treaty, then what is the other party going to do about that? So it really does depend on the nature, the flavor. I mean, if this were an overwhelming 90% to 10% vote, let's get out of the EU, one can imagine there would be more political impetus and sort of an upper hand for the Brits in saying, you know, we're out, but you guys can take or leave what you want from our, you know, trade with the British economy or whatever. I think that's extremely unlikely. And unfortunately, my cynical side is saying that although polls in recent days have shown a significant lead for the Leave campaign, we found, for example, that polls were indicating potentially that Scotland was going to vote for independence. Was it last year they had their independence vote? And of course, that did not turn out that way. People, when they get to the polling booth, either magically transform into much more status quo supporting people, or the votes are manipulated and it's not who votes that counts, it's who counts the votes. Again, my cynical side says maybe it's more of the latter than the former. But in either event, I am not hopeful for the prospect that, say, come this time next year, that Britain is going to be a free, fully independent nation again, apart from the yoke of Brussels.
Do you think they'll be on their way to achieving that status, or do you think that the attempt to leave the European Union will be throttled by then?
I can't imagine David Cameron would be the one helming this departure, because, of course, he's the one out campaigning for the Remain in EU. So, but then again, he would probably have to step down as Prime Minister if he did. If the referendum did go in the Leave direction, so who knows who would take over and in what context, and you know how would the British government reform in the wake of such a referendum if it were to go ahead? Again, this mm-hmm. is pretty uncharted territory in a lot of different respects, not just in the European Union situation specifically, but just in terms of world geopolitics. It's not often that this form of independence campaign it takes place peacefully and politically. And as you say, I mean, there's at least the specter of the nuclear umbrella of sorts that Britain has up its sleeve if it really wanted to take it to that level. Again, I'm not expecting it would go.
No, I don't expect that. I don't expect that to happen. But if the European Union allows England to just say, okay, we're out of here, and it makes it as painless as possible. Well, you mentioned, I think you mentioned Scotland. There's also the Netherlands, Sweden, Denmark, and France. There are movements afoot in those countries to leave the EU. Don't know that it'll happen in all of them. But the European Union has something like a vested interest to make England suffer in order to scare the other ones off as an act of deterrence. You'd better not try to leave this union. You know, we'll give you a dose of what England got.
Yes. And I think they do want to make an example of this. And that's exactly why we see the coverage of this skewing heavily towards a fear campaign, essentially. If you leave the EU, Brits, you know, the world is going to fall apart. The economy is going to come undone. It'll be, you know, chaos on the streets. And I think that's underlying much of the coverage behind this. including, I mean, really, that's the subtext of that Time article that you're reading from, the idea that these negotiations are going to be long and messy and sticky and it's uncertain. Do you really want to go through all that, Britain? No, of course you don't. Just stick with the status quo. It'll be safe and comfortable.
You wrote another article entitled Banksters Threaten Brits, Don't Brexit or Else. You mentioned they had a whopping 10-point lead. The Brexit, those in favor of leaving, were ahead by 10 points in a recent poll. Rupert Murdoch's Sun newspaper urged its customers to believe in Britain, and he's apparently supporting the idea of Britain leaving. Ambrose Evans Pritchett is encouraging Britons to vote for separation. And then a couple of very interesting quotes. Stripped of all distractions, the referendum comes down to an elemental choice. Whether to restore the full self-governance of this nation, Britain, of course, or to continue living under a higher supranational regime ruled by a European Council that we do not elect in any meaningful sense, and that the British people can never remove, even when it persists in error. I mean, there really is. This isn't just a situation where they're fighting, they're struggling about whether we should stay in this union because we can make a good dollar off of it, or we can go our own way and sell more cars in someplace else in Africa or wherever, I don't know what. But this has some real powerful political implications. And it goes to self-governance, the right to appeal decisions by the European Union's court. There's a lot at stake here that sounds like freedom. It sounds like the English are in a position analogous to that of the United or the 13 colonies back 230 years ago or whatever. There's something at stake here that's more than just money. Do you get that feeling?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, this is ultimately about ideology, and it's ultimately about the globalization, which is clearly on the agenda for the banksters and the various political institutions that they puppeteer. Clearly, that's the direction that they want to take the world in, consolidation of power and control. And the majority of the public is not really on board for that agenda, but they are on board in the sense that their polities sign them up for it, whether they want to or not, or whether they understand the process or not. It's not like the European Union is some well-functioning, well-thought-out, very, you know, nicely structured system that's easy to comprehend. It is, I would assume on purpose, a labyrinthine organization that few people have any understanding of, to the point where most people are only discovering now that there are, in fact, four presidents, quote-unquote, of the European Union. There's the president of the European Council. There's the president of the European Commission, there's the president of the European Parliament, and there's the presidency of the Council of the European Union, which of course is different than the European Council. And most people don't even know what these different institutions are, how they function together, how they differentiate themselves, which of these four presidents, quote unquote, can actually be called the president of the European Union. The official answer is there is no official answer. There is no such thing as, quote, the president of the European Union. But again, most people have no understanding of this system. And I don't blame them for that. It's a ridiculous and, as I say, labyrinthine thing that people can't wrap their heads around, precisely because it is fundamentally a bureaucracy that exists to confuse and bamboozle the public, while the European Central Bank and the real arms of power of the European Union make their machinations behind the scenes and in a more low-key fashion. And ultimately, I think you're right. I mean, I'm 99% on board with what you're saying and the way you're framing it, but it's the 1% that somewhat scares me, because the implication is, okay, so if we can devolve this power from these, you know, international organizations like the European Union back down into national governments, well, there you go, that's freedom. Well, no, I don't think so. No, continue the process. No, not national, state or provincial. No, not state or provincial, local. No, not local, individual. And it has to be about the opposition of individual freedom to these greater political unions, which by their very nature, are an abrogation of those individual freedoms. It's, I guess, the question of how much of an abrogation people are willing to put up with. So to the extent that people want to deglobalize, I'm 100% on board. To the extent that people want to bolster the idea of a national government, I can't say I'm on board.
Well, we see General or Great Britain, they're raising awareness of what the European Union's reality actually is. I think the idea that you can't, you sign up, you say, we have a referendum today, we want to leave, and then it has to be negotiated for 2 years, during which time you have no say in what the European Union, you can't leave, but you can't say, they won't let you out, but you have no say in how the European Union operates for the next 2 years. This is oppressive. I think this is going to inspire some people to say, we got to get out of here. I don't care how much money we can make. This is an oppressive regime. And I think Great Britain is perhaps raising awareness of that perspective. And if it is, people like Scotland or nations like Scotland are going to say, let us out of here. You know, next thing you know, they won't let us wear our kilts or whatever. Strange times. One last brief comment before we run out of time, probably only have about a minute and a half left. WikiLeaks will publish enough evidence to indict Hillary Clinton, warns Assange. This was in the Russia Today. WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange warns more information will be published about Hillary Clinton, enough to indict her if the U.S. government is courageous enough to do so. Do you think we're going to see something explosive still coming out of WikiLeaks? And if so, do you think the government has the courage to indict Hillary Clinton?
I hope people who read at least the headline of that article would have the sense to ask, why on earth would an organization like WikiLeaks, that is supposedly devoted to global transparency of all these public institutions, announce that they have these documents and then just sit there? We're going to release this explosive information, trust us, but let's just wait a little while. That is...
Well, they're playing politics.
At the very least, and perhaps deep politics, to put it in a more accurate perspective. I think WikiLeaks is controlled opposition at the very best, whether that's controlled by Julian Assange consciously or whether that is controlled by the intelligence agencies that no doubt feed them many of the documents that they then go on to release. Either way, it doesn't matter in the end. So I'll believe it when I see it. Put up or shut up.
All right, we're going to have to put up and shut up, I guess, at least on the radio program, because we're out of time. I want to thank you, James, for being on the program. As always, enjoyed it. Folks, thank you for listening. I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank the producer, and James Corbett. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dreams, I have a plan. If I got me a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work at all. Money, money.